sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today you're going to hear the second part of a speech by Dr. David Ray Griffin, given at the University of Hartford on Friday, May 7th, 2010. The third and final part of his speech will be aired next week. Since this was taped live, there are a few minor imperfections to the audio quality that couldn't be edited out. Dr. David Ray Griffin has written 9 books on 9/11, and he has 2 more coming out in the fall. He was also nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize in 2008 and 2009. He's a very credible researcher and was a former professor at Claremont University in Claremont, California. So here he is, Dr. David Ray Griffin.
Besides the fact that the men labeled the hijackers were not devout Muslims, they may not have been Muslims of any sort. And if that were not bad enough for the official story, there is no good evidence that these men were even on the planes. All the evidence for this claim falls apart upon examination. Now, I can only give a couple examples. In the book, The New Pearl Harbor Revisited, I give many examples. I deal with every bit of evidence that has been given to convince us that these men were on the plane. And I show that they all fall apart, some of them ludicrously so. One of the purported proofs that the 19 men identified as the hijackers were on the planes was the reported discovery of some of their passports at crash sites. But the reports of these discoveries are not believable. For example, the FBI claimed that while searching the streets after the destruction of the World Trade Center, they discovered the passport of Saddam al-Sukami, one of the hijackers on American Flight 11, which had crashed into the North Tower. But for this to be true, the passport would have had to survive the destruction of the North Tower, which for some reason pulverized everything into tiny particles of dust except the steel and al-Sukami's passport. This claim, as you've illustrated, was too absurd to pass the giggle test. By 2004, it was modified to say that a passerby picked it up and gave it to a New York police detective shortly before the World Trade Center towers collapsed. So rather than needing to survive the collapse of the North Tower, the passport merely needed to escape from al-Sukami's pocket or his luggage, and then from the cabin of the plane, and then from the building without being burned up or even singed by that giant fireball that exploded immediately and fell to the ground. This version was no less ludicrous than the first one. And the other stories about passports at crash sites are equally absurd. If you want another illustration, ask me about the passport found at Shanksville, where United 93 supposedly crashed. It is widely believed, of course, that we know there were hijackers on the airliners thanks to the numerous phone calls from the passengers and crew members on the 4 airliners, in which they reported the hijackings and described the hijackers. But we have good reasons to believe that these calls never occurred. For example, about 15 of the reported calls from that day were said to be cell phone calls, and about 10 of those 15 calls were said to have been from one airliner alone, United Flight 93, sometimes called the cell phone flight. And 3 or 4 of those calls were to one person, Dina Burnett. And she said she knew that she got her call from her husband, Tom Burnett, using his cell phone because she looked at the caller ID, and there was Tom's cell phone number. However, given the cell phone technology of 2001, cell phone calls from high-altitude airliners were not possible. They were generally not possible over 1,000 feet. They were certainly not possible over 35 or 40,000 feet where most of the calls were allegedly made. Articles describing the impossibility of these calls were published in 2000 and 3 and 4 by two Canadians, one of these with A.K. Dewdney, who was formerly a regular columnist for Scientific American. And he did experiments. He found every cell phone he could, took them up in little planes. These little planes, single-engine or double-engine planes, have much less insulation than an airliner. And even in them, he found he couldn't get anything above 7,000 feet with a double engine or over 9,000 feet with a single engine plane. And so he concluded that cell phone calls from airliners, which have much more insulation, airliners from 35 or over 40,000 feet were flat out impossible. Perhaps in response, the FBI changed its story. In 2006, it presented a report on phone calls from all four planes for the trial of Zacharias Moussaoui. You remember the so-called 20th hijacker. In its report on United Flight 93, it said that cell phones were used not for 10 calls, but for only two, and that those calls were made when the plane was descending, about ready to crash, so it was at a very low altitude. And those two cell phone calls were said to be the only calls that day that were made on cell phones. So the FBI implicitly agreed with the 9/11 Truth Movement that high-altitude cell phone calls were not possible. Now, at that time, Popular Mechanics, which had put out a defense of the official story, was being interviewed on a show supporting the official story, put out by the History Channel, which really should be called the Herstory Channel because it's partly owned by the Hearst Corporation, which published the Popular Mechanics book. And this is something they did not disclose in the show, even though they used the Popular Mechanics crew as their ultimate authorities. And this fellow from Popular Mechanics was saying, oh, no problem, 30,000, 40,000, even 50,000 feet you can make cell phone calls, not knowing that the FBI was pulling the rug out from under them and saying there were no high-altitude cell phone calls. The FBI therefore avoided a big problem, which was making a technologically impossible claim in a court of law. But in doing that, avoiding that problem, it created another one. What do you do about all the people who said they got cell phone calls that day? Now, most of them said they were told by the person, their spouse or friend, that he or she was calling on a cell phone. Some of them said, well, they'd borrowed it from a neighbor on the plane. In those cases, you might conclude, well, maybe they misheard, misunderstood, misremembered. It would be a little puzzling that all those people made the same error, but you could believe that if you wanted to strongly enough, perhaps. But even so, what would you do about Dina Burnett? She saw several calls, saw that the cell phone number of her husband was on her caller ID. Now the FBI says Tom Burnett called using a seatback phone. If that's true, how did his cell phone number get on his home phone's caller ID? This is something that no defender of the official story, including Popular Mechanics, has ever explained. How do we explain it? Well, it seems like there's only one explanation. These calls were fake. Now, how could they have been faked? Three different ways, as far as I know. One is voice morphing. In 1999, a story in the Washington Post by William Arkin, a well-known writer about military and technological matters, he reported that he had attended a demonstration of voice morphing. And in that demonstration, he had heard the voice of Colin Powell say, "My captors are treating me well." He heard the voice of another well-known general saying, "Ladies and gentlemen, we have just started World War III." Neither of those generals had made those statements, but everybody in the room would have sworn they had. That's how good voice morphing already was in 1999. Now, how do we handle the cell phone ID? There are little devices. You can order these that tell you you can fake the caller ID so somebody doesn't know what you're calling from. That's one possibility. Another possibility is somebody simply had taken Tom's phone from him, called Dina from the ground, used voice morphing, and convinced her, so it didn't have to fake the phone number. A third possibility, All those people who made the calls were on the ground but had guns to their head and were given scripts to read. So you've got three different ways to fake, but any of them, you didn't have phone calls from the airliners reporting hijackers. So the phone calls cannot provide good evidence that these guys were on, alleged guys, were on the plane. Now, this is confirmed further if we look at the most famous phone calls from that day, those from Dina Burnett. You remember the CNN commentator who was married to Barbara Olson, I'm referring to, married to Ted Olson, who was the Solicitor General for the Department of Justice. Now, Ted Olson's a very important person for the Bush administration. He's the one that argued in 2000 during the disputed election in Florida that the vote recount should be stopped. And he convinced the Supreme Court of that, and that's how we got the Bush-Cheney administration. He was also a very important person on 9/11 because he told CNN and the FBI that day that his wife Barbara had called him from Flight 77, the one that supposedly hit the Pentagon, and that she had told him that the plane had been taken over by hijackers who were armed with knives, and the whole world knows the hijackers had box cutters. But of all the calls that day, this is the only one, this is the only reported call or set of calls in which box cutters were mentioned. So this shows you how important these alleged calls were in establishing the official mythology of that day. Now, Ted said that in these calls, the first time he talked to her for about a minute, and the second time, 2, 3, or 4 minutes. What did the FBI say in 2006? Well, it had a little problem. The plane was too high for cell phone calls, and Ted went back and forth, first saying cell phone, then seatback phone, back and forth. But the other was a problem, too, because we found out in 2005 and then confirmed in 2006 that the 757s that were made for American Airlines, and that's what Flight 77 was, did not have seatback phones, did not have onboard phones of any sort. We got that from 2 customer service people. I've since talked to pilots and flight attendants who flew those planes regularly, and they said, that's right, there were no onboard phones. So what was the FBI going to do? Now, whether that's the reason, I don't know, but here's what they did say. These are on the web. You can go on and read them. My book, New Pearl Harbor Revisited, tell you how to find them so you can see them for yourself. And they put a little graph up there, and it tells you what kind of phone was used and what number was called and how long the call lasted. Here's what they said about Barbara Olson, that she attempted one call. This call was unconnected and therefore lasted 0 seconds, not 1 minute, not 2, 3, or 4 minutes. Now, how many of you knew that? Not very many. Wouldn't you think this would be something that should be a screaming headline? Because the FBI is part of the Department of Justice. And here the FBI has put out a report saying that these calls reported by the former Solicitor General of the Department of Justice that were instrumental in starting the war on terror, these calls never happened. You would think that would be big news. So the alleged phone calls do not provide evidence of the presence of hijackers on the planes. In addition to the lack of good evidence for their presence, we also have good evidence for their absence. A psychiatrist sent a FOIA request to the Pentagon asking for the autopsy report from the Pentagon attack. They refused. He persisted. They refused. He persisted. They finally gave it up. And he then reported what he saw. There were no hijacker names on the autopsy report, no Arab names whatsoever. Then, if you go look at the passenger manifests for the 4 flights, you'll find the same thing. No hijacker names, no Arab names whatsoever. And if that isn't enough, try this. In the cabins of these planes, there's a transponder. There's a universal hijack code, 7500. If there's any sign that a hijacking may be in progress, the pilots are trained to punch in the hijack code. This takes about 2 seconds. On Flight 93, they tell us, and they play a recording, that's supposedly a genuine recording of what was happening. It took the hijackers 30 seconds to break in there. And in all that time, neither of the two pilots punched in the hijack code. Same thing on the other 3 flights. All 8 pilots failed to do this very simple thing that they're trained to do. This is called squawking the hijack code, and it lets the people on the ground, the FAA controllers, know that a hijacking is in progress, and so they send up planes to intercept. The intruder theory on 9/11 is disproved by the pilots who didn't squawk. It appears, therefore, that 9/11 was the most elaborate example yet of a false flag attack, which occurs when countries wanting to attack other countries or groups orchestrate attacks on their own people while planting evidence to implicate those other countries or groups. Hitler did this when he was ready to attack Poland, and that started World War II. The Japanese did the same thing when they were ready to attack Manchuria, and this started the Asian part of World War II. After Castro had taken back Cuba for the Cubans, the United States wanted it back. And the Joint Chiefs of Staff brought to President Kennedy in 1962 a proposal called Operation Northwoods. The subtitle was Pretext to Invade Cuba. And they gave a whole list of possible ideas. And several of them involved killing Americans and blaming the Cubans. This was not put into effect because Kennedy vetoed it. But in 2001, the White House was occupied by an administration that wanted to attack Afghanistan, Iraq, and 5 other predominantly Muslim countries. They had 7 predominantly Muslim countries on their hit list, including our good friends, the Saudi Arabians. And so it appears evidence was planted to implicate Muslims. I turn now to the strongest evidence that the 9/11 attacks were orchestrated by insiders rather than foreign terrorists. The destruction of the World Trade Center, and especially World Trade Center 7, which is the topic of my most recent book, The Mysterious Collapse of World Trade Center 7, Why the Final Official Report About 9/11 Is Unscientific and False. I speak of the mysterious collapse because from the very beginning, the collapse of this building was seen as the biggest mystery of 9/11. Given the fact that the Twin Towers were hit by planes, which then, because of their jet fuel, started big fires, many people thought they had an intuitive understanding of why the towers came down. But Building 7 was not hit by a plane, and yet it came down at 5:21 that afternoon. This would have meant, assuming that it was not deliberately demolished by using explosives, that it had been brought down by fire alone, and this would have been an unprecedented occurrence. And science doesn't like these. It has this little fetish about the regularity of nature. New York Times writer James Glantz wrote, "Experts said no building like it, a modern steel-reinforced high-rise, had ever collapsed because of an uncontrolled fire." Glantz then quoted a structural engineer as saying, "Within the structural engineering community, Building 7 is considered to be much more important to understand than the Twin Towers because engineers had no answer to the question, why did 7 come down?" Moreover, although Glantz spoke of an uncontrolled fire, there were significant fires on only 6 of this building's 47 floors. And these fires were visible for at most 3 to 4 hours. And yet fires have burned in other steel frame high-rise buildings for 17 or 18 hours, turning them into veritable towering infernals, and not a one has ever collapsed. Not even a single floor has collapsed. So why did 7 come down? FEMA, which in 2002 put out the first official report on the World Trade Center, admitted that its best hypothesis with regard to World Trade Center 7 had only a low probability of occurrence. And those of you who are scientists know that science speaks for we don't have a clue. By its best hypothesis, FEMA meant the best hypothesis it could articulate in light of the fact that as a government agency, it could not posit the use of explosives. Now, why might anyone think that explosives had been used to bring the building down? One reason is simply that prior to 9/11, every collapse of a steel frame building in the known universe had been produced by explosives in the procedure known as controlled demolition. Collapse has never been caused by earthquakes, fires, or any cause other than explosives. Another reason to posit explosives is that this building came straight down, collapsing into its own footprint. How many of you have never seen a video of the collapse of World Trade Center 7? Don't be embarrassed because they haven't wanted you to see it. How many have never seen it? Quite a few. Here's what happens. The building is standing perfectly still, and at 5:21, all of a sudden, in Toronto and Montreal, it was great. Richard Gage was with me, so I didn't have to do this. They could just look at the video. And I just today got an email from a guy in Australia who had seen Richard when he was down there a few months ago. And he said it was so amazing when Richard showed this video of Building 7 came down and about half of the audience gasped. It's that startling. If you think that fire brought down the building, it's startling because for the building to come down that way with an almost perfectly level roof line, there's a little tiny kink in it, but otherwise it's perfectly level. For that to happen, all the steel columns supporting it, all 82 columns had to fail simultaneously. This is what happens in this kind of controlled demolition known as implosion, where you take out the middle columns, get the little kink, and then you take out the others in the order and in the way that makes the sides fall in upon themselves. So it ends up as a rather tidy little pile, this once 47-story building. This is done with explosives. This is not something that fire can do. So simply seeing the video shows anyone who knows anything about these things that the building was brought down by explosives. On 9/11 itself, CBS anchor Dan Rather said, "It's reminiscent of those pictures we've all seen on television where a building was deliberately destroyed by well-placed dynamite to knock it down." You can be sure that never played again. In 2006, a filmmaker asked Danny Jolwinkel, the owner of a controlled demolition company in the Netherlands, to comment on the video of 7 coming down without telling him what it was. Even though this was Jolwinkel's business, he didn't know a third building had come down that day. And so when he saw it, he said, "Well, they simply blew up columns and the rest caved in afterwards. This is controlled demolition." When asked if he was certain, he replied, "Absolutely, it's been imploded. This was a hired job. A team of experts did this." An organization called Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, which was formed by Richard Gage in 2006, now has over 1,200 members. Many of those joined after they saw the collapse of World Trade Center 7. In light of these considerations, an investigation seeking the truth about this collapse should have begun with a hypothesis that 7 was brought down by explosives. This is basic scientific method. You start with the most likely hypothesis based on precedent. However, this did not provide the starting point for NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, which took over from FEMA the responsibility of putting out the official reports on this building. Instead, NIST said the challenge was to determine if a fire-induced floor system failure could occur in World Trade Center 7 under an ordinary building contents fire. So although every other steel-framed building that has collapsed did so because of explosives, NIST said, we think fire brought this one down. To understand why NIST would have begun with such an unscientific hypothesis, you need to understand that NIST is an agency of the U.S. Department of Commerce. And therefore, during the 8 years it was working on these reports, it was an agency of the Bush-Cheney administration. And this administration was accused by the Union of Concerned Scientists of distorting science for political purposes more than any previous administration. And this document was signed by over 15,000 scientists, dozens of them being Nobel laureates and National Medal of Science winners. Also, a scientist who had worked for NIST reported that by 2001, it had been fully hijacked from the scientific into the political realm, so that scientists working there had lost their scientific independence and became little more than hired guns. One manifestation of NIST's political nature may be the fact that it delayed its report on Building 7 year after year after year until the Bush-Cheney administration was about to leave office, releasing it only late in 2008. Be that as it may, NIST did, in August of 2008, finally put out a report in the form of a draft for public comment. Announcing this draft report at a press conference, Shyam Sunder, NIST lead investigator, said, "Our take-home message today is that the reason for the collapse of World Trade Center 7 is no longer a mystery. World Trade Center 7 collapsed because of fires fueled by office furnishings. It did not collapse from explosives." Sunder then added, "Science is really behind what we have said." However, far from being supported by good science, NIST report repeatedly makes its case by resorting to scientific fraud in the technical sense. Two of the major types of scientific fraud, as defined by the National Science Foundation, are fabrication, which is making up results, and falsification, which means changing or omitting data. Claiming that it had found no evidence of a controlled demolition event, NIST simply omitted or distorted all such evidence. Some of this was testimonial. Two city officials, Barry Jennings of the Housing Authority and Michael Hess, the city's corporation counsel and Mayor Giuliani's good friend, reported that they became trapped by a massive explosion in Building 7 shortly after they had arrived in this building at 9 o'clock that morning, shortly after the first attack on the towers. However, NIST claimed that what they had called an explosion was simply the impact of debris from the North Tower collapse, which didn't occur until 10:28. So this was at least an hour after the event they reported. NIST rather obviously distorted these men's testimony.
That was the second part of a speech given by Dr. David Ray Griffin at the University of Hartford on May 7th, 2010. Tune in next week to hear the third and final segment of that speech. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.